Network proudly presents The Jay Clay Show. Your host, CyberGolf.com's own Jay Clemmer, and co-starring a galaxy of the golf and sports world's greatest names that special. Yo, 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 this is your main man, DJ Q, telling you to put your hands together for your friend and mine, Jay Clemmer.
All right. Thank you, DJ Q. He is absolutely right. That's why he's the best in the business. You are listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network. And I am Jay Flemma. Welcome to the show, everybody. We are here the week before the Players Championship, one of my very favorite tournaments of the year. And so we're going to be talking about that. We'll also be doing a little U.S. Open preview as well. Jay's Place is brought to you by JB's Best Hot Sauce. It's the boldest, it's the spiciest, it's the most amazing hot sauce out there on the market. It's on every table in the Deep South, and it should be on yours. When it says JB's, it's the best. All right, everybody, we've got a very special show lined up for you right now because our next guest is a major champion. Our next guest has won the Players twice. And our next guest is having a wonderful career now as both a broadcaster and a writer. Give a warm Jay's Plays welcome to the one and the only Steve Elkington.
That's quite an introduction there, Jay.
Well, you earned every bit of it. You know, it really is a pleasure to have you on. One of my very favorite memories of you, and I know we're going to talk about Sawgrass, but one of my very favorite memories of you is watching you win that PGA Championship. Take us back just for a minute and tell everybody about that great day for you.
Well, you're referencing the 95 PGA that was played out at Riviera. It's an iconic golf course, and I was having a great year in 95. For a number of reasons, I had won early in the year, had a lot of confidence. My daughter was born. My first child was born in April. Everything was going well for me, and it all came to a head, if you will, at the PGA at Riviera, where I shot a last round 64 and got in a playoff with Colin Montgomery, and then I had a storybook ending where I made a 30-footer in front of the world to win my first major championship. It was fantastic.
It's a wonderful setting, the 18th green at Riviera, carved into that hill, you know, with a wonderful California sunset going over the Pacific Ocean. You know, they do say there's a saying in golf, beware the joyous father. So, a lot of people do credit the birth of your young daughter as part of the sort of the fuse that lit your terrific season. Now, we're big fans of golf course architecture here, and that's why we're big fans of Riviera in particular. Talk about a great place to win your major. But what a lot of people don't realize is some of the great golf course architectural tricks go by the board at Sawgrass because everybody's got their eye on the island green. So you've won twice at Sawgrass. What's the secret to beating that difficult Pete Dye golf course?
You know, when I inducted Pete Dye into the, I think it was into the Designer Hall of Fame after, maybe 10 years ago. And I was telling everybody that when Sawgrass was designed, it was almost considered like futuristic, right? It was like all these mounds and all these islands and all this crazy stuff. And then Jerry Pate won with an orange ball, remember, and dove in the water on 18. And now when you're
demon in the water.
Exactly. And now it's almost considered traditional. But of course, to play well at the TPC course, you have to have precision, maximum precision. I read Tiger Woods committed to, obviously, Charlotte this week and Players next week, and they asked him the same question. He said, it takes absolute precision to play well at Sawgrass.
Well, there are a lot of, tight driving areas there. What Pete Dye said was he absolutely wanted to keep the golfer off balance by making you hit driver on one hole, then making you club down to something else. turn you left to right off the tee, but right to left into the approach, and then switch it up on the next hole. For example, at 14, 15, where one is draw off the tee, fade into the green, but the very next one's fade off the tee, draw into the green. So you really can't get into that comfort zone of a repeating swing. Is that something that you had in the back of your mind or noticed while you were playing Sawgrass?
No, that would have, you might have psyched me out if I knew all that. I just looked down there, and Pete has a way of visually intimidating you. In fact, the first time I went to Sawgrass and I teed off on number 10, I looked down there and I said, I can't play this course. And my caddy said, what do you mean? You haven't even hit a shot yet. And I said, it's too narrow. I mean, it's too intimidating. And anyway, he does that on purpose, right? He makes it very visually intimidating. But the secret to playing well at Sawgrass, you have to fight. So normally speaking, like you just mentioned, hole number 14 or 18. Let's take 18. Everybody knows 18 with the water down the left. He wants you to see the water. In fact, he told me he wanted your ankles right on the bulkhead when you teed off. He wanted you to hear the water slapping against the bulkhead. And what that does to a player is it makes you go to the right. It makes you play out safe. Now, when you do that, he's got you pinned because now you can't get into the green. So the trick, if there is a trick, is to play down the tightest line, which is down the water's edge, which is where everybody doesn't want to go. But that's where you got to go.
Sure, Pete is a genius at giving you the various angles, and the A position is usually the most dangerous, but the further out you go, the safer you play, the tougher your approach shot's going to be in. For example, the further away you play from that water, you're going to be in those rough covered mounds. You're not going to get a good lie, and you're not going to have an even lie, and you're going to be headed right back towards the water because it all slopes that way, like you said. That whole has the camber that follows along the curve of it. A phenomenally designed golf hole, and one that he's repeated in some other courses as well. Now, we mentioned 14 and 15 and 18, but tell us some of your other favorite holes at Sawgrass.
Well, you know, you just talked about 14, 15, you know, 13, 14, 15 was kind of a small gauntlet. You had to get through those holes. Some of the hard holes on the front nine, which is, you know, 4, 5, 6, are always been difficult to maneuver your way. You mentioned where the ball has to be hit, different shapes. To be honest, it really suited my game. I've always considered myself a straight driver. I mean, I've proved it there twice by winning it, but, where you really can gain strokes on the field is good iron play, and that's what I'm known for. A lot of the champions at Sawgrass, like Nick Price comes to mind, you know, some of these guys that can drive the irons in lower with more spin. You've got to have a pin high shot because there's so much trouble. I remember Hal Sutton, he won twice there, Davis Love twice, Jack Nicklaus 3 times. So all the guys that do well there, they all have similar ball striking traits. The course is not long. It's only 7,000 yards, so it's a pushover in length-wise. But you can't push it over with your tee ball. You can't do it.
Now, I'll tell you, one of my favorite stories about Sawgrass is that he told me not too long ago that when he originally designed it, as you know, everybody complained, and there was even so much petition drawn up because they were very upset with how difficult it was and visually intimidating it was. And so it underwent changes. And Pete tinkered with it for many years. And around 2005 is when he said to me, Jay, it right now is back in pretty much the exact form in which I gave it to them back in 1980. I'm not going to tell that to them myself, but I find it kind of funny. We had a good laugh about it. The one big change, though, is that he had the 16th green going away from the player. He wanted the idea to be for people to try to chase the ball in one bounce and on, and you know, people just didn't do that. The pro game has maneuvered so far away from that that pretty much the only time you'll see that will be in an Open Championship. And, you know, you still don't see it that often. Maybe the greatest example that I've seen was Todd Hamilton. You know, he won the Open at Troon in 04 playing One Bounce Phenom all the time. But you don't see that that often at Sawgrass. But that's one thing that Pete said to me, is he gave them pretty much the exact same golf course he gave them in 80. So do you think that people's attitudes towards golf tech architecture and design have started to get better over the years and become more accepting of the kind of golden age features that Pete has going on his courses, but kind of go by the boards because you don't see him because he's scaring you so much with the visuals?
That's a couple of questions in there, but yeah, I think Pete, when he first designed TPC, it was a style, right? It was a style of a course. It was a stadium style. It was new and fresh that the fans would be above the play so they could sit up on the sides and look down, and it's a wonderful place to watch golf. I got to do a course with Pete. I designed the TPC Louisiana with Pete, and I learned so much from him about a lot of things you don't see, you know, the good drainage and all that, the uninteresting things. But when it came to strategy, he would always, when we were out together building TPC's Louisiana, he'd say, oh, I'm going to put this bunker over here, Elk. He said, this is going to catch Phil Mickelson. I'm going to set him up on the tee, and he's going to want to think he can go that way, and I'm going to catch him right here. He's like a fly trap guy. You know, he's like, I'm going to get this guy, and I'm going to get that guy. And that was the way he designed. And look, I say there is a lack of great golf courses, new courses being designed. Otherwise, we'd be playing them all. How come, you know, the most famous courses in America, in everybody's top 10, there's no new ones in there. They're all old ones. National, Shinnecock, Pebble Beach, Augusta, Cypress Point, Pine Valley. They're all 50 plus years old. So the other architects must have been better suited, don't you think?
Well, I'm happy to say that I'm seeing a wonderful resurgence, and I think that it takes time for some of these courses to rise up through the ranks. People have to sort of, you know, get out there and see it first. It takes a long time for a Cabot Links or a Baron Neal, for example, to become known to the mainstream. And remember, each of these magazines have completely different ranking systems. For example, Golf Magazine has just 61 people. But Golf Digest, for example, anybody with a high handicap or lower can get on that panel, so there are potentially thousands of panelists. Now, you know, we discussed this openly and candidly. Some of those people didn't know what the heck they were looking at. They were defining a good golf course as hard or easy, short or long, hot cart girls, good burgers. That's not how you rate a truly great golf course. Two-thirds of what you're looking at is design. What's happening in the earth? Does it have vertical movement in the earth? Does it have horizontal sweep to the fairways? Those are two great things Sawgrass has. Okay, there's excellent vertical movement in the earth. Not so much that you're going way uphill or way downhill, but you're going to get uneven lies and you're going to get strange bounces. Number four is a perfect example. A short par four, but very sexy because there's danger all over that hole. How would you play the fourth hole?
Again, it's what we talked about earlier, is Pete puts trouble down the right, so your eye makes you go left, and of course, you know, over to the left, so dead. You know, you get on those mounds over there, you just can't play to a sort of a half island hole. I remember trying to, you know, I remember Nick Price holding out a shot from the right hand bunker. I keep telling my friends that, or the people that, you know, with Secret Golf, some of my players, they say, how do I play Sawgrass? In fact, I got a major championships caddy on my phone right now asking me, his player can't play there, and I'm going to walk him through a few things. But you've got to go down the trouble side, and of course, as you know, the right side of number four is a sand bunker, but it's only a foot deep. I mean, it's not like it's, you know, 8 feet deep bunker that you can't get out of. So I would say to you, I try to hit it right down that right edge, and if I go in the bunker, I better have my bunker game sharp so I can clip one out of that fairway bunker. It's not a hard shot.
Sure, but it, like you said, is intimidating. And then you play to a green with excellent undulations, and that's the third thing that people are looking for when they're determining the great design of a golf course, is, you know, how good are the greens? And the greens at Sawgrass are terrific. You know, Tom Watson criticized him and said he took Augusta's greens and miniaturized them. And that's Pete Dye said, thank you. That's exactly what he's trying to do. Augusta's greens are too big, he thought.
It's great. I mean, the banter between, you know, architects and players and vice versa is always interesting to me. Crenshaw is probably Crenshaw and Core stand out as some of the new, you spoke of some of the courses, and I agree with you that they'll have to earn their time to get to the, up into the forefront. But then they have to, of course, the infrastructure around it then will also have to be included if there's going to be a tournament there. You mentioned Cabot Links. It'd be great to go up and play Cabot Links, but it may not be able to hold a tournament. So there's that merging factor, right, where you've got to have the course has got to be designed properly, and then now you've got to get all the people in there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why they build these beautiful stadiums so that all the people can sit in there, right?
You know, it is nice to see that the TPC has done that and made it easier for the fans to move around. I can speak firsthand to how difficult it is at times to move around covering a U.S. Open at a place like, for example, Olympic Club, where you have to go back and forth to get your way up the hill or else you're going to slip and fall because it's so steep, or a place like Marion, which is so small and yet there were so many people. I remember the horror story one time. All I wanted to do was go out and get an iced coffee, and there was a stand that had iced coffee in the middle of the golf course. The only problem is when I got out there, A, I found out that one of the crossings that would take me back to the media center didn't exist and was blocked off. And as I happened to be there, guess who came in behind me? Well, Tiger and his two playing partners and about 16,000 fans, and so I'm stuck there for 45 minutes and I can't move.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not necessarily the fact that a course can hold a major tournament. Some of these older courses are seeing excellent redesigns or seeing excellent restorations, and that's another reason I think why we see some of these courses that have been on top for so long stay up there, because they're getting a wonderful spit shine. Wingfoot, for example, had Gil Hanse come in, and their East course has been polished to a high shine, and it is truly every bit as good as the West course. And someday, if anything ever happened to the West, they could probably hold an Open on the East. Old Town is another, where Core and Crenshaw came in at Wake Forest University, and they took out all the rough, and an expansive 6-hole playing area is all interconnected, separated only by bunkers and hills and a creek. And it makes for a wonderful old school feel. I really enjoy their architecture as well. Core and Crenshaw will be on display at the U.S. Open at Shinnecock. So let's turn for a minute to Shinnecock. What are your memories of Shinnecock Hills?
Shinnecock is so hard. I played in 95, was the year that I won the Varden Trophy, and we spoke about the PGA. That was the year that Corey Pavin won it. I think I was maybe top 25 or something like that. It was about the best I'd ever did in the U.S. Open, but it's just a bruiser, right? It's 7,500. It gets windy. It's up and down, sand hills, and now they've taken all the trees out, so we're more exposed. It'll be probably the hardest test of the tour this year, for sure, going to Shinnecock. There won't be any harder course that the tour players will face than that one this year.
What exactly makes Shinnecock so difficult? What shots in particular, what features?
Oh, I think it's, you know, that's a good question. I think it's undulating course. It's long. It has a lot of shots that are blind shots that go over areas that you don't feel so comfortable about knowing where the fairway is on the other side. Now, people say it's only blind once. Once you know what's on the other side, you should be okay. But I think it's six comes to mind, 10 comes to mind. There's a lot of drop-offs and up over things, cutting across corners. It's very well designed. It's just a very difficult piece of property to play on. Although, you know, we've seen some good scoring there, but I just don't know what they're going to do setup-wise. The USGA is kind of, I don't want to say lost their way, but last year, as we recall, Jack Nicklaus said about Chambers Bay?
He said was Aaron Hill.
Aaron Hill, he said that that course did not resemble any U.S. Open course that he'd ever remembered. However, I thought it stood a good test there. I think the best player won, and that's the main thing. So Shinnecock is just a difficult piece of property to play on. Always uneven lies, windy, small greens, long course. Very difficult.
Well, you know, it should make for an outstanding Open, and it does get bonus points for its storied and venerable history as well. In particular, one of the more interesting architectural things that's happening there, we don't recall ever seeing this, but two of my guys that play in my main rotating group of players are members of Shinnecock and National, and one of them has been feeding me information steadily about the restoration work and about the work that the USGA has been doing. And the story broke, I broke the story in Golf Course Trades, and I'll be publishing it for Golf News Net soon, that what they're doing is something completely different this year. They're ripping up one side of those big wide fairways that Coren Crenshaw gave them, rolling up that sod, shipping it in a truck to New Jersey to a sod farm for storage, and rolling out fescue that they grew at a sod farm in New Jersey, or rolling out fescue that they tore up from the short course at Shinnecock Hills. And so as one of my sources says, it's instant rough, or McRuff or McAstroturf, one or the other. But it's a very strange and unusual way to do it, but it does seem to solve the problem of narrowing the fairways quickly so that at least driving accuracy maintains some semblance of importance at the U.S. Open.
Mm-hmm. I agree. That's a strange way to do it because it sounds like they've changed their mind midstream, but hey, it sounds like it'll be effective. The U.S. Open's a mind game. You know, players that go there with the right attitude can play well there and you know, chip out when needed. Other players get frustrated and run up a big score and they get themselves out of position in the tournament and they never recover and it's over for them that week. So it's all attitude. You're going to miss fairways. Everyone is. The winner is too. And it's patience. It's a lot of strategy. Where should I play so I don't make a big score? And this, you know, it's different. Where's an opportunity to score? The players will figure that all out, but ultimately at the U.S. Open, it'll always come down to whether or not you can hit the tee ball in play.
It is good to know that they are going to keep that as an important factor. I've noticed since the Mike Davis era began that driving accuracy has significantly decreased in importance when you look at where the winner stood on the list of driving accuracy. You frequently find him in the 20s, 30s, or 40s, which you would not find that back in, say, the Tom Meeks era or before. You would find the guy T5, T7,
yep.
T2. But what that has done is it's allowed recovery shots back into the game even more so. You know, what were your experiences? Tell me your most acute U.S. Open moments, you know, that made you say, boy, man, I really am playing in the world's toughest tournament right now.
You say my bad experience or my good? I didn't really have any good experience in the U.S. Open. My son, who's 21, said, Dad, you should have won the U.S. Open. You're the straightest hitter I've ever seen. And I was one of those guys. I honestly believe that I was a little psyched out for the U.S. Open when I got up there and saw that rough. And I don't know why. I mean, I should have used that to my advantage. But I remember shooting like 86 at Oakmont where I kept driving in the rough, chip out, knock it on the green, and two-putt, make a bogey, and just go on down the road. And my wife, I remember one night I was coming home after 86, and I went in and had a bath, and she poured a bottle of Crown Royal in there. She said, why don't you sip on this pretty good and get over this 86, and maybe tomorrow will be better. That's what I needed after an 86.
Well, I'll tell you, okay, at least it's better than the one fella, okay, I think it was Jimmy Demerit, who was walking on in, and somebody else saw him and said, where the heck are you going? And he goes, I'm done. I'm in pocket. But what he meant by in pocket was that his score was so bad that he just decided to hit his tee ball into the turnpike, and it landed on the back of a truck that was carrying, I forget whether it was stones or dirt or something, and the ball just sailed down the turnpike, and he said, that's it, I'm out of here.
Oakmont
will do that to you.
Yeah.
Let's take a break for 1 second. It's time for the trivia question. We do this every single show where a person gets a trivia question from JB's Best Hot Sauce and gets a chance to win a bottle of hot sauce and a t-shirt that says, I'm a hottie. But unfortunately, because you are working with GMN, and we can't do that whole thing where, you know, the family and friends of the company.
Can you have a sample? You like have a little sample pack of hot sauce I can squeeze a little on or something, just a little taste?
I got to tell you, if you love good wing sauce, this is the right one. Okay, we'll see what we can do since you're family. At the very least, let's throw you the trivia question and see if you get it. So now let me find it here. Okay, here we go. Your category, and you might get this one, your category is comic books. Okay, here you go. Spider-Man's alter ego, Peter Parker, worked for the magazine, the newspaper, the Daily Bugle. Who was his manic Spider-Man-hating editor-in-chief? I'll read it to you again. Peter Parker, who is the alter ego of Spider-Man, worked freelance for the newspaper The Daily Bugle. What was the name of his manic Spider-Man-hating editor-in-chief?
This is such a funny trivia question for me, mate, because I'm from Australia and Wagga Wagga. I know who Spider-Man is now because of the new movies, but I have zero idea of any comic book about. We didn't get any comic books in Wagga Wagga, so I got the buzzer. I got nothing for you today.
No, if you saw the movies, take it. Who was the cigar chomping crazy man that ran the newspaper?
Mate, I never even seen the show. I've never even seen Spider-Man show.
Well, his name was J. Jonah Jameson, and he was infamous because here's Spider-Man working for him and, you know, getting him all these killer pictures of Spider-Man and selling all these papers and making him all this money, and he doesn't even realize that it's Spider-Man that he's talking to every other day. Alright, well, we gave it a shot. I tell you what, we'll see what we can do about getting out a sample bottle because it really is good. John Burwell used to write for the PGA of America. I would see him in the media tent at all the majors. Excellent writer and even better guy, and he decided to chase his dream. And basically, JB's Best is a delicious wing sauce in a bottle. It's that good. Okay, we have them as a sponsor because I believe in that product. I think it's really great stuff. Alright, so let's spend the rest of our time. Tell us about Secret Golf. For all of our listeners that aren't familiar with it, you know, what is your latest, greatest project that you're working on?
Well, Secret Golf is a passion of mine. I started 5 years ago, and basically, it's a pretty simple concept. I shoot the intellectual property of all the tour players. I have 30 tour players, 6 LPGA, and 24 tour players. Basically, we've always known the most about golf. We've decades perfecting our craft, and now with the internet, we're able to film all this content, we're able to put it into a matrix, and we're able to deliver this content in small pieces to the consumer. And by that I mean, we believe at Secret Golf that you need to get the right video for the right swing mechanics that you need right now to the right handicap. In other words, it's always been a one lesson fits all from all these people in the industry. And we believe it's possible to customize it, and we've proven so. We can personalize your content through data, through scoring, through your choice, through curriculums. It's wonderful. And we've got all this great content for you to work on your game.
Terrific. How many people do you think you've helped since you've started the project, and how long has it been going for you?
Well, we've had 5 years. We'll do 25 million people will come by and look at that, our content this year. So there's a lot of people that are interested in golf. And, you know, with the internet these days, there's been a big push with a lot of subjects. For example, there's history professors that get together now that are the best minds in the world about history. And you can subscribe now to getting some of the great history lessons from great professors. And it's no different than golf. We can get all the great minds of golf together. We can develop this product, and we can get it out to the consumer like they've never been there before. We're totally bringing them behind the scenes.
What are the websites, and what are the URL addresses, and what other way can people check this stuff out and stay in touch?
Yeah, you can follow us. You can go straight to the website at secretgolf.com, @secretgolf, Twitter, @secretgolf, Facebook, Instagram, all Secret Golf, all the way. Yes, we're having a lot of success. It's it works well. Even Ryan Ballingy gets over there and learns a thing or two every day. He goes over and checks us out.
Now, are there any live events that you've scheduled in the past, or are there any live events coming up soon?
We do live events when we come to the majors. We film a podcast with Diane Knox, who's Russell Knox's sister. She has a fastest growing women's podcast called Secrets and Lies. I do one with her called Elkin Noxie. we put out a lot of content at Secret Golf on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We just try to keep as much information flowing from the best minds in golf. And we work on those people and we nurture those people to, you know, help them get their games better and answer all the questions that they need, you know, what they need to know.
Will the next events be at Sawgrass or will we see you at Shinnecock?
We'll definitely be at Shinnecock. Maybe Sawgrass. I got a lot of players playing this week in Charlotte. Perez and Duffner finished second last week. Brittany Lynchicum's won already this year. We've had Andrew Landry. You were talking about someone that just had a child, one of our players that won at San Antonio. We've got a very nice, we're building a nice ecosystem of players that are helping one another, being around Jackie Burke, myself, and talking to one another. And we've had, I think it was our 15th win in the last 14 months of our tour players winning on tour. So it's been pretty good for the players as well.
Well, it sounds absolutely fantastic and a lot of fun, but the best has probably got to be when your readers come in and say, hey, I tried that tip and it worked for me.
Yeah, when it's the best, of course, is, you know, we have highly curated content, which means that, you know, for example, if you go to the backswing button on Secret Golf, there's a search engine in there, and you could go to backswing, and inside of backswing, there's subcategories. There's the slot at the top. There's the takeaway. There's setting of the wrist. There's what's the body doing? What's the arms doing? So all these different subcategories. If you're thinking to yourself, you know, if I could just get my hip turn, I feel like my hip turn's out of sync. You can go to that subcategory and actually catch every one of our tour players in that position and have you hear it from their own voice of how they get themselves in that position. And it's a wonderful teaching aid. I wish this was something that I would have had. I only had a photograph of Jack Nicklaus on the wall when I was a kid. So we're very happy with the way things are shaping up for us, Secret Golf.
Well, I know all about that because I keep it in my golf bag and I still look at it. I have a two-page sort of magazine circular that shows Jack, Tom Watson, Ben Hogan, in the six critical positions. You know, the most important one for me being the fifth, where you're coming down, but your wrists still haven't broken yet. You got the beautiful V. That was one of my, call it an epiphany. That and, of course, the reverse C. You know, it's funny, take it from somebody who, you know, goes everywhere from being a 9 handicap to a 30 handicap and everywhere in between in the last 20 years, that relearning everything from scratch to try to get it into those beautiful classic positions like that isn't easy. So having something like Secret Golf to be able to go to every single day at any time, even 12:30 in the morning when I can't sleep, to be able to reinforce not only all of those positions, but how you get into them, that's a beautiful thing. It's going to save you strokes, you know, and you're going to learn a lot faster.
No doubt. And I think, you know, having 30 tour players and hearing the same, you know, the same message, you can pick what also, like, you know, I got a lot of people that are tall that come in and I say, hey, you know, look at Jason Kokrak, you know. I got other people that are short. I said, go in and look at Jason Duffner or Brian Harman for left-handed or you know, Andrew Landry. It's a sort of fit of a stop, you know.
With me, I think you'd need to have Frodo Baggins there. Or maybe Ian Woosnam. So, a couple of quick fun questions before we let you go. If you had a bunch of your buddies come over from Australia and say, take us to 5 public places and take us to 5 private places, rattle off a list of 10 places you would take them to see, you know, golf course design in America.
Well, I'd go to Pebble Beach. Would be on the public side, right out of the gate. That's probably one of my favorite courses ever to go to. Bethpage in New York is a brute, but it's a beauty. I might throw Hilton Head in there just because you can get on that course. It's pretty public. You can get on that track. Bandon Dunes would be in there as another public track. I'm trying to find a nice Texas one. I can't think of it. Private, my list would be different. It would be National, which is funk. It has the most funk of any course there ever was. Much trickery, everything. Cypress Point, of course, Augusta National, of course. I'd go somewhere like Colonial in Fort Worth is a wonderful course, and I'd even throw in Westchester up in New York is a wonderful hilly, slopy kind of small green situation. I never won it, but I have to throw Riviera in there too because I won the PGA there.
Those are all wonderful, wonderful choices. I'll throw a couple out to you as well. Okay, if you're going to go out to Pebble Beach, see if you can get them on the wonderful Monterey Peninsula Country Club, both the shore course
so good.
And the dunes course. Yeah,
I just played the brand course. New. I just played the shore. It's wonderful. It's probably as good as Cypress Point almost. It's unbelievable.
And there's a reason for that. Mike Strantz knew that that was the last golf course he was going to design before he died of cancer, and he knew that he was in between Cypress Point and Pebble Beach, and he said,
yeah.
I wanted to do something that would blend beautifully with both of those.
Yeah, that's great.
I also loved your New York City choices. I'll throw out Sleepy Hollow, where another magnificent restoration is underway. 5,000 trees have been cleared. You can see all across the Hudson River at the fifth green, the skyline green with the pins silhouetted against the blue sky, just a breathtaking moment. And then their wonderful punch bowl followed by a magnificent short bowl. Colonial, I played Colonial on a January windy day where the entire course was a beautiful golden overseed and the greens were emerald. Oh, it was nasty, but it was surreal. It looked like a Tim Burton film. Okay, no leaves on any of the trees. It looked almost like Halloween. It was so beautiful. One of my very favorite memories, my straight job, I'm an entertainment and sports lawyer, and one of the rock bands I represent are from Dallas, and they're all golf. They're called Bowling for Soup, and so I brought them out in their knickers and hats to play. And Gary the drummer got lost in the woods on one hole, and all of a sudden I see the ball come rocketing out of the trees, goes onto the green, a little bit of backspin, stops pin high. I said, my God, what a magnificent shot. Did you move the ball back in your stance and close the face a little bit? He goes, no, I just closed my eyes and prayed.
sounds like a drummer.
what do you call a guy who likes to hang out with musicians?
Yeah,
a drummer.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And finally, of course, I have to tell my home course, Forsgate, the Banks course. You mentioned National Golfings of America, the first created by the bloodline of McDonald, Rayner, and Banks. The Banks course at Forsgate is the last one, and it has all the great template holes, including a magnificent Baritz green, 84 yards deep, 7 feet deep, swale 25 feet across, with the long tusk bunkers extending on both sides, stretching all the way back to 272 yards. And I watched Annika Sorenstam beat Brad Faxon by one stroke, and it was her making a par on 17 to his bogey. That was the final nail in the coffin to finish him off, pretty much. But anyway, Steve, it's been magnificent having you on the show. I look forward to having you on again. We'll try to get you on after the U.S. Open so we can talk a little bit more about how successful Secret Golf was at the tournament.
Thank you very much, Jay. It was great to hear all your thoughts about architecture, and keep up the good work. I'll see you soon at the U.S. Open.
Fantastic. I look very much forward to it. Everybody, we'll be back with the second segment in just a minute. We're at the end of another great Jay's Play show, but thank you all so much for joining in. It's no fun doing this to an empty room, but it sure is fun doing it for all of you guys, so thanks so much. I want to thank Fish for kindly letting me use their great music as a theme song for the show. Thanks, guys. I want to thank CyberGolf and Golf News Network, cybergolf.com/writerscorner, including me and all the other fine writers, and thegolfnewsnet.com/radio. Take us home, DJQ.
Tune in next time for another great Jay's Play show on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
Thanks, guys. Catch y'all next time.